Today on Vox Talks, the trillion-dollar hole in America's GDP from giving up on free markets. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Where is the epicenter of capitalism, creative destruction, and competition? All of you immediately thought the United States, but Thomas Philippon of NYU, he's also a CEPR fellow, has recently published a book that argues that in the last 20 years, the US has given up, his words, on free markets. And as a result, its economy is $1 trillion smaller, and its families are each $5,000 a year poorer. Thomas joins me today to talk about what is called the Great Reversal. Welcome to Vox Talks.
Thank you for having me.
It was the cost of cell phone plans and internet access that got you into all of this, wasn't it? So what happened there? What's changed to those prices?
Yeah, I think it's because it's the more salient part when you are a consumer here, that the prices that you actually notice. For me, it also comes from the fact that I came here 20 years ago as a student, and I noticed that many goods and services were cheaper in the US than in Europe, where I had lived before. I mean, I knew quite well Berlin, Paris, and London, actually. So I could compare directly, and I noticed, wow, you know, getting access to internet is a lot cheaper in the US than in Europe. And then the cell phones were also, cell phone and cell phone plans were also cheaper 20 years ago. And today it's the reverse. And it's not a small reversal. It's not like Europe has caught up and then we are about the same. Is we are less than half the price of the US. Like you get your broadband connection in London for less than half of what I pay in New York for the same speed. You get your mobile phone plan for less than half of what I pay in New York. So that's how big the difference is.
And you're arguing that markets in the US are less free, and this is what has caused these prices to rise or not to decline. How do you measure how free markets are?
That's the trick, right? That's the hard part. So, I mean, the first thing you want to do is recognize that there's no perfect measure and that the only sensible approach is to look at all possible indicators to get a big picture. So the way economists think about a free market is, in a sense, in a static way, in a dynamic way. The static way, you sort of look like whether the big firms look like they have a lot of power. So you look at their market share, and you think that if the biggest firm controls a lot of the market, then you think, presumably, it has market power. Okay, so that would call for looking at measures that in economics we call concentration measures. So you look at the market share of the top 3, 4, 5 firms. And if this is a high number, then you're thinking, well, they are likely to be able to raise prices because there is nowhere else to go. And also they are likely to collude. If there are only 2 or 3 of them, like the telecom industry in France before deregulation, there were 3 operators. It was not very hard for them to, you know, maybe you could say, oh, by coincidence, they all agreed that the right price was $49.99 and shouldn't change. Or you could say, well, they clearly colluded on that price. I think it's obvious they were colluding. So that's the static view. The static view can be very misleading because a market can become more concentrated because the firm that was already pretty good is getting even better. Okay. In which case, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be worried because the reason you observe growing concentration is not that the leader is doing anything wrong. It's just that it's running faster than the other guys. So the dynamic view really, I think, in my mind at least, the most important focuses on free entry, which is the market contestable? Can somebody else enter the market? And so in the book, I look at all of these measures. I look at the profit margins of the firm. I look at the prices they charge. I look at the concentration of the market. And I look at some measure of turnover, if you want, or entry of new firms. And when I see all of these pointing towards the same direction, which is lack of competition, then I say, well, I'm pretty confident something is wrong.
You also point out in the book the massive influence of lobbying in the US. How much bigger a business is lobbying in the US than it is in Europe?
Well, so the trick with lobbying is that the data is not very good. So you have to make a lot of guesses. My guess is 2 or 3 times higher on a, you know, per capita or as a share of GDP. But it's very hard to know precisely. The US used to have really good measures of lobbying since the 1990s, where they passed a law essentially requiring all businesses to report everything they spend on lobbying. But that law has become weakly enforced. So today it's hard to know exactly how much. A lot, for sure, but how much exactly? And also, the way the influence works is not directly proportional to how much money you spend, is where you spend it. And a lot of the money that's spent is well hidden. For instance, many of the firms have, you know, non-profit organizations attached to them, foundations that they use strategically to influence policymakers. Another thing that's very important to understand in the US is the cost of running a successful political campaign. That has skyrocketed over the past 20 years. So today, as a politician, it's very hard to get anywhere without accepting donations from large firms, because the how much you can spend on a political campaign is pretty much unlimited. So that's a big difference with Europe, where every country in Europe has some form of limitations on the size of campaign finance spending. And that limits the power of lobbyists, right? Because the way it works in the US is first you finance the campaign, and once you've financed the campaign, if your candidate wins, then you have access to that candidate. Okay, so you pay for access by paying for the campaign. Once the candidate is in power, then you can spend on lobbying with a chance of winning. That's how it works.
And you're concluding that the money that's spent on lobbying by people who would want to gain market power or restrict free access, that's money well spent.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, most of the time. I mean, sometimes you could have some silver lining, because you could have two lobbies fighting against each other. And then, you know, they might end up spending a lot, but they mostly cancel each other out. So that happens too, in which case the total amount spent is not necessarily a sign that the policymaker is going to be swayed one way, because it's pushed with equivalent strengths in two directions. At the end, it doesn't move. So we see some of that. But the smart ones, they keep it under the radar. And they focus on the stuff that matters. They focus on influencing the groups that are likely to, for instance, take merger approval. If they want to get their merger approved, they focus on the part of the system that is going to be in charge of approving the merger. So they could be directly the regulator, or it could be the politicians who vote the budget of the regulator. That's even smarter.
Now, I quoted those two big numbers that you've come up with in the intro, the $1 trillion and the $5,000 a year per household. Those are really very high. Did they surprise you?
Well, a little bit, but it's so just to give you a sense, it's, that statement means that at the end of the day, when I look at all the numbers together and I cross-reference the 10 ways I have to think about market power, I think that prices in the US are about 7% too high. Okay. So is 7% a really big number or not? Well, I think it is actually turned out to be quite large. So that's an average. Of course, in the telecom, I think they are twice too high. So that's kind of ridiculous. But of course, the telecom is an extreme example. There are some markets in the US that are very competitive still, like retail, for instance. Retail trade is still very competitive. So if you take the average of all of that, you get something like 7%. So then you translate that into how much it is for household. For all the households together, that means they're overpaying by something like $500 trillion a year. That would be like the direct saving from just lowering the sticker price. But if you think about that, would not be the end of the story if you thought about what would happen if the economy was more competitive. Because a more competitive economy has plenty of virtues. Some of them is firms hire more, firms invest more. I think arguably also firms would innovate more, although that's harder to capture. So if you put these pieces together, the economic feedback of the virtues of competition, then you translate this 7% higher prices into a loss of private GDP of about $1 trillion. Private GDP in the US is 20 trillion, so we're talking about 5%. So I'm saying private GDP is 5% too low. Yeah, it's big. It's not like moonshot big, but it's still very... What's interesting is that it's relatively more important for people who earn labor income. Because in my simulations, if I look at what happens if I dial back the clock and I make the economy as competitive as it was 20 years ago, then because the economy is more competitive, the profit margins of the firms tend to decrease, which means payment to capital owners, so dividends, stock buybacks, these payments have to decrease because there's just less money flowing in that would go into the pocket of the shareholders, one way or another. Okay. The flip side is wages go up. So in fact, I grow the pie by $1 trillion by making the economy more competitive. But on top of it, I redistribute about $250 billion from capital payment to labor income. So the true increase in labor income would be something like $1.25 trillion. What that means is if you look at the distribution of people in the US, the impact of higher competition would be mostly beneficial for the middle class. That is, so the middle class is the median household in the US earns about $50,000 per year, you know, give or take. So for these people, most of their income is labor income. And what that means is that if you have a policy that encourages labor income, such as competition, the impact is actually very big for them. So my estimate for the median household, for the middle class, is that for them, the gain in purchasing power or standards of living is almost 10%. That is almost $5,000 out of 50. And the reason is because they don't really have much dividends. So they don't really care whether the dividends go down or the share buyback. And most of their income comes from labor income. The very poor, that's different, because very poor, mostly they get subsidies from the government. So I don't think they would necessarily gain that much. The very rich, they might lose a little bit or a lot because they get a lot of capital income. But for the middle class, that'd be a good policy.
You have kind words to say about European regulators in the book. And as Europeans, it's kind of hard for us to talk about how efficient our regulators are without smiling. Are they really doing a better job than American regulators?
Well, that's a low standard. So what is for sure is they are doing an immensely better job than they were doing 20 years ago. That's obvious. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly thanks to the influence of Europe and the single market. And by the way, the irony, of course, is who was one of the main architects of the free market approach to the single market? Which country single-handedly pushed for free market in Europe?
UK.
So one of the reasons we have a free market DNA in the DG Comp, in the part of the commission in charge of enforcing antitrust, is thanks to the UK. It's thanks to the UK plus a bunch of stuff I explain in the book, which is that even though European countries by themselves don't have a tradition of free market and didn't really have any interest in having free market at home, you know, the French politicians like to play dominoes with these industrial firms and foster their national champions. And they were never big fans of the idea of consumer welfare and independent regulator in charge of enforcing free market. That was never the French tradition. But at the European level, the game was completely different because they thought, okay, if we're going to be in a single market with all these countries, Germany in particular, then maybe we would like to be able to tell, you know, the commission what to do. But that's actually less interesting now because there is a risk that if we can, then somebody else can as well. So the game in Europe shifted from being focused on national politics towards, okay, if we're going to be in the market together, we want the referee to be independent. It's not because we like independent referees. It's because it would be really bad if the other countries could team up and influence the referee against us. And every country in Europe thought the same. And the small countries, very importantly, thought exactly that. I mean, if imagine you're like, you're Belgium, the Netherlands, or Portugal, and you're like, okay, I'm going to be in a single market with free trade of everything. And I'm going to give the key to the regulation of the big firms to the commission. I mean, they can block mergers. And I'm in this system with France and Germany. Would I join that club if I thought that France and Germany could just bend the rules and do whatever they want? Of course not. So then the solution was to make the referee very independent. So that's the virtue of Europe. And I don't think people fully understood what it meant at the time. Well, they understood what they were doing, but they didn't understand the far-reaching consequences. And so 20 years later, you have something like the merger between Siemens and Alstom, which was pushed by Berlin and Paris together and was blocked by the commission. They were right to block it, by the way. It was pure merger to monopoly. And that's a very strong signal that this is a good institution that's working well. Now, it's not true for everything in Europe. The two things that work great in Europe are DG Comp and ECB. Central bank is great, doing its job. And DG Comp has improved the life of European consumer a lot. And there is absolutely, they should be commended for that. And also notice that they attract the best and the brightest. I mean, it's not by chance that Mario Monti was the head of DG Comp. It's not by chance that Margrethe Vestager is the head today. These are the smartest cookies. They are brilliant and they are very good politicians. Why would they choose that job? Well, that's because it's a place that actually has power and works pretty well. So I think that's a testimony to big success of Europe. That doesn't mean that there is no big failure in other areas. There are plenty.
Healthcare in the US is another area which most people would accept has spiraling costs that can't really be justified in a free market. Can we apply the same logic to the way that healthcare works that you applied to telecoms or retail?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that it's a conservative estimate is that a third, I think it's closer to one half if you ask me, of all the money spent in healthcare in the US is pure rent to monopolies. And how do they get away with it? They lobby like crazy. They lobby shamelessly in all directions to keep their prices high and to keep the, to keep merging when we know hospital mergers are mostly negative for patients in terms of quality of care and prices. I think that in that sense, it's very similar. What is different is the alternative. See, like if I look at the telecom industry, the way we got low prices in Europe is just competition. I mean, literally, we just brought in competition. In France, we had three operators. And we said, that market sucks. Let's bring a fourth one. Actually, the fourth one was wanted to, Free Mobile wanted to enter. They entered and they just killed the price. They just dropped the price by one half in 2 years. That's it. So that's pure like free market, the way it should work. You can't really apply that model to healthcare. Like there is no free market alternative to healthcare. So because every country in the world has some form of price control. Essentially, there is no way you can regulate healthcare without some form of price control. So the pure free market doesn't work. But limits on lobbying and limits on political influence of pharmaceutical firms and hospitals, that's clearly something that is very similar in the healthcare and other industries in the US.
Now, at the other end of the spectrum, the tech sector in the US has some very successful, arguably very innovative firms, also very dominant. Would you argue that concentration is a bad thing there?
I think this one is exactly what we were discussing early on. Whether there's two ways to look at competition, you can look at concentration, which is kind of a static way to look at it, or you can look at dynamics, whether there is entry, turnover. In the tech sector, you want to really look at both. Because I think that early on, you could really make the case that the market was competitive and that Google and Facebook got to where they are by being mostly better than their competitors. So that was fine. Today, of course, the way they maintain their power is absolutely not okay. So there's a difference between how they got there and what they are doing today. I think they got there by being pretty good, and then they are staying there by quashing competition in a way which is oftentimes, if not illegal, at least very problematic from a consumer welfare perspective. And so that's why we need to do something about that today.
I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke to your colleague, Luis Cabral from NYU, specifically about tech industry mergers. His argument was against strong ex-ante regulation of tech mergers, mainly because it's simply impossible to know how markets will develop. Do you disagree with that?
And he was proposing more like ex-post reviews?
Yes, exactly. Let those mergers go through and then regulate afterwards.
I think we should be pragmatic. I think let's agree on one thing, the old-fashioned model where you would have firms apply to a merger, you do a full analysis, you understand very well what's going on, you say yes, no, and then you move on. That model doesn't work well with tech. Because at the time you have to make the decision, there's so much uncertainty. In particular, because oftentimes the merger involves a very new product or a firm that is not even making money yet. So when Google bought DoubleClick or YouTube, when Facebook bought WhatsApp or Instagram, at the time of the merger, the targets were tiny most of the time, not really making money. And we didn't really know what they would become, right? So it would have been very hard to do a comprehensive analysis and be sure of the right decision. So this old-fashioned way of doing it, I think I agree with Luis, that doesn't work in tech. After that, I think we should just be very pragmatic. That means we should have all tools. The first thing is we should revalue mergers based on the value of the target, not the income of the target. That is, if Facebook is willing to pay $20 billion for a company that is not making money, then the fact that the company is not making money should be utterly irrelevant because they are telling you they are willing to pay $20 billion. That's all you need to know. So that's kind of step one. Step two, we need a bit more flexibility ex post. We need to be able to come back. Now, the thing with the flexibility ex post is the political economy of that doesn't fly very well because once the merger has happened, these guys have so much lobbying power. Good luck with undoing it. So in an ideal world, yes. But if you're going to tell me we're going to be a bit more lenient ex ante so that, and we're going to review mergers ex post, then I want the regulators to be much more independent and stronger and better founded than they are today. Because otherwise, that thing is not credible. And the third thing is, I think at this point, I think we should also have some kind of precautionary principle, which is it's okay to block a merger. It's not the end of the world. Because if really it should have happened, then it's going to happen 2 years later with maybe another firm or another firm. You know, there's like a ratchet effect. Like the merger is hard to undo. So you want to be a bit prudent. And these are not sectors that are declining. So in sectors that are declining, they need to merge because otherwise they are not going to survive. In that case, there is a case for actually approving some merger. But in a sector which is expanding, you're not going to kill anybody by preventing a merger. the worst case scenario is there would really have been great synergies and you're going to slow down a tiny bit the rate at which they're going to innovate. But it's not a permanent effect, because if it's really great, then somebody is going to do that merger 2 years later. So I think the case for being prudent is stronger in this industry.
If someone made you policymaker tomorrow across the market, not just in tech, what would you do that could really shake things up? Do you think it's time to start breaking up some of the larger firms?
In the US or in Europe? Because in Europe, I think they are doing mostly the right thing.
In the US.
Yeah. So in the US, again, I think the only pragmatic approach, you need to try everything. So there is a strong case for arguing that you cannot run a platform and operate on the platform from the same company. So I think that the market for online advertising, where Google is running the auction platform and at the same time advising or participating in the auction itself, I think that's crazy. And in financial markets, that would never be allowed. Mm. That's a complete conflict of interest. So clearly there is a case for trying to do some kind of breakup. Now, I think breakups are at best unlikely to succeed. And even if they were to succeed, it would take many, many years. It's a very blunt instrument. So I think that there is no plausible way that this is enough. You need also to have some regulation. So I would always move on 2 feet, like antitrust and regulation at the same time.
And the economic disaster that we're living through now, do you think that this is going to make the problem that you've observed here and written about in your book, is it going to make that problem worse?
Well, in the short term, almost mechanically, yes, because we know that the survival rate of small firms is lower than the survival rate of big firms. Mm. That's true in most recessions. It's going to be even more true in this one. So we're going to have a high death rate of SMEs, while the big firms are going to mostly survive. So mechanically, that's going to lead to higher concentration. On the other hand, it's not a foregone conclusion in the sense that you can have very active policymaking to protect the SMEs. If you look at what Germany is doing, what France is doing to try to protect small and medium firms, I think it's so far it's been quite successful. I hope that that way we can alleviate the death of small firms. On the big firm side, it's going to depend also on policy, but there is no obvious reason why things would be much worse if we have the right policies. To take an example, like right now we are using Zoom for this podcast. Zoom has multiplied its network by a factor of what, 5, I don't know, 10, something like that, over the past 3 months. And now it's clearly become a household name and it has a chance of being a true competitor to all of these social networks. Same thing with WeChat or Slack. So I think that there's a good chance that we can also have some entry from this crisis. But then we need to protect them. Hopefully, Zoom should not be a target for an acquisition by Google. I hope it's obvious to American regulators.
We will wait and see. Thomas, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The book's called The Great Reversal, How America Gave Up on Free Markets by Thomas Philippon, and it's Harvard University Press. Thomas, can we read anything into the fact that as an economist, you've written this book, but you also choose to live in the United States?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that the book is not saying that the US is doomed. One way of thinking about it is, what are the big advantages of the US? I think that clearly universities, I would broaden that also to say universities together with private research labs, that's the innovation ecosystem of the US, and they are still leading the world by far. There's no question about that. They have the funding capacity, like through the venture business and also some the financial markets willing to finance startups, which means that they can bring startups to market. They are the best at that. And the last one was they used to have a relatively uncorrupt system, very strong and independent regulator, and free market that provided a good deal for consumers. I think they just lost that one. I hope they're going to get the act together and reclaim it. But they are still leading in the other two. And the flip side for Europe, I think they've done a great deal for consumers, but clearly they need to work harder on innovation. These are not incompatible, right? These are just different dimensions of success.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks and you will never miss an episode. And remember, you can find 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.